Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will chat with an investigative journalist about immigration and customs enforcement in Ohio. Jay will also have a chat about communities in schools and will learn just how livable Columbus is. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Back in December, Operation Buckeye was a targeted week-long ICE immigration enforcement operation that resulted in 280 individuals being detained. Reports suggest that 80% of those detained were Latino, 90% were male. 137 of the 280 ended up in the Butler County Jail, which has been under fire amid allegations of overcrowding, cruel and unusual punishment charges, and poor medical care. Rico Moore is an investigative journalist with The Margin in Washington. He's been following these and other ICE stories and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, Rico.
Hey, thanks, Jay.
What have your investigations revealed about ICE detention facilities nationwide, and where does our Butler County Jail in Southwest Ohio stand among them?
Yeah, so our investigations for The Margin have focused on a migrant detention facility in Tacoma, Washington, southern end of Puget Sound there. And what we found, which is not unlike other facilities in the nation otherwise, or, you know, but what we found is that at least in the facility we looked at that's contracted by ICE to the Geo Group, private prison company to run it, is that the facility was sited on top of a EPA Superfund site, so a very toxic site. It was set adjacent to a fuel oil facility that contaminated the groundwater with diesel fuel. It was sited on top of a former meat packing site, and all in a heavy industrialized area near an oil refinery, liquefied natural gas facility, and other facilities that, you know, pollute the air, as well as a major highway and a train kind of depot there that, you know, pollutes the air, diesel exhaust. So we have also obtained records from detainees that of complaints of the water being contaminated. And so while these complaints have been intended to be investigated by the Department of Health, the State Department of Health, the Geo Group and ICE have refused to allow Department of Health officials to enter the facility. Well, all aspects, all parts of the facility to test the water to rule out this contamination. And at the same time as this environmental pollution is going on, there are the other, you know, human rights abuses, such as alleged assaults by guards against detainees, and they're not being responded to, at least as of our last story in October, by the Tacoma Police Department. So there are some issues in oversight from the environmental end of things, from the State Department of Ecology, the Environmental Protection Agency, certainly Geo Group and ICE, and the Tacoma Police Department and the City of Tacoma. So that's kind of what we found.
My question to you is, the Butler County Jail in Ohio is not a private prison. It's a state-run prison. And Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has ordered an investigation after the jail came under alleged abuses, poor conditions, something called the Warden Burger. Would the state of Ohio have oversight over the Butler County Jail as it pertains to ICE, or does ICE supersede the state's oversight?
What we have found in Washington is that these questions of jurisdiction are real questions that are being litigated right now, currently before the Supreme Court, in fact, between Geo Group and Washington, the state of Washington. The question of the Supremacy Clause is a major issue, not only in detention, but also in immigration enforcement. You've seen different laws being passed across the country. And one law in particular, and certain instances that are starting to really kind of pique my attention, have to do with the use of the local law enforcement to enforce local laws against ICE agents. And so there's some real questions there. There are probably going to be some cases that rise to the level of Supreme Court, like between the state of Washington and the GEO group right now currently, as to whether, for example, the State Department of Health in Washington has the authority to, number one, you know, enter this facility, this detention center, and test the water to rule out contamination based on state law, or whether ICE has jurisdiction over that, and whether the State Department of Health's attempts to test that water, you know, supersede, as you say, or trump, if you will, the federal government's jurisdiction.
Well, and it makes it extremely complicated in Butler County, because the Butler County Sheriff's Office not only has a contract with ICE, but they were the first county in the state of Ohio to have their sheriff deputies be sworn in as certified ICE agents. So how can they police themselves against their own abuses if those abuses are occurring? That's the question in Ohio. And take it one step further. You know, I know you've seen the news and you know what the populations are like. So there's significant Haitian and Somali populations in Springfield and Columbus. Will entire communities be deported, or will ICE efforts focus solely on those with criminal records? What do you know?
As far as racial profiling, that seems to have become practice. I understand that, you know, that's been a part of it, and so that's a legitimate concern. I would be concerned myself if I was of those populations.
In Northwest Ohio, immigration policies have prevented one couple from bringing home a foreign adopted baby. Is that something that will continue? And are other foreign babies born living in the United States now potentially at risk?
I honestly don't have the specific legal context or understanding to answer that question.
So what can states do if they suspect ICE abuse?
I mean, I think right now what I can see, at least at Washington State and a bit more nationwide, is that states are attempting different state legislation to, uphold the Constitution and defend constitutional rights for their citizens. I think that there are several bills in multiple states that do that. And I think it's sort of to be seen, to be honest with you. I think a lot of these are going to be, you know, passed or failed in state legislature. They're going to be probably enforced in different ways by different law enforcement agencies. And they're probably going to be tested in court. And it sort of remains to be seen. But I think that's kind of where we are, is can local law enforcement uphold certain laws at state level against federal agents. And that's a real question. And that's what we're facing in Washington State. What we're seeing is this real battle between the state Department of Health and ICE via the GEO group and their facility there. So the question also has to do with, do private corporations, are they de facto agents of the government, or are they private companies based upon their contract? And so you mentioned a facility that's contracted by a county government. And you mentioned also, you know, can an agency or an entity oversee itself? And then obvious questions that raises about conflict of interest. And another thing to look at, I would say, that we found in Washington State is that the city of Tacoma, where the detention facility sits, has or had investments in the retirement fund into GEO Group. So it's also important to look at a lot of these dimensions, you know, including whether or not the state level, the municipal level, county level, if there's a kind of retirement system, if they have investments into the company itself, what type of taxes do they get? Do they get business and occupation taxes? Do they get property taxes? Are politicians being given campaign donations by whatever company that might benefit from that very specific?
So there are numerous action. Areas of potential conflict of interest that you have put out there. But there's been talk of President Trump invoking the Insurrection Act. If that happens, and that's a big if, How would that alter immigration enforcement, and what potential impact would it have on civil liberties? Is it just game over?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, that's such a significant and serious question, and I don't have the legal capacity, or I haven't reported on that specifically. So I'm not going to kind of opine on that, but I do want to acknowledge that it's a very serious and real question, and it's a real, you know, it's a one of concern. Absolutely.
What do you hope to accomplish as a result of your investigation? What is the end product going to be?
Well, you know, we're working on our third story, and we've written three, you know, long form investigative stories focusing on the impacts to, you know, former detainees, and as the goal of any reporting project is to bring to the truth to light, and so that, you know, the people who are in positions of power can hold those committing wrongdoing accountable, and to hopefully stop harm from happening.
So even though there are some parallels between what is happening in Ohio and your investigation in the state of Washington, and obviously there are very clear differences, do you plan to expand your investigation to incorporate Ohio and Minnesota and other states so that you have a compare and contrast model?
Yeah, it's certainly on my mind. I think that one thing about investigative journalism is that, you know, to have a lot of impact, it sometimes will help to stay focused on one specific area. But I am looking into some other facilities in the Midwest, yes.
All right. We want to thank Rico Moore for being our guest, talking about the impact that ICE is having across the country and in our neighborhood. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, Communities and Schools focuses on supporting students and strengthening education and career pathways across the state, with a strong concentration in Central Ohio through collaboration with schools and community partners. CEO Adara Robinson joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss building opportunities that connect education to real-world outcomes. Welcome, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am doing fine. How does CIS ensure that the services that you provide are directly tailored to the unique needs of each school's neighborhood and community?
That's a great question. When our site coordinator goes into a school and when we develop a partnership with that school, we set up and putting together a school needs assessment and understanding what the needs are for the entire school, and that's in partnership with school leadership and other staff. And then we also develop student need assessments and understanding what those individual students need, whether it's academics, attendance, behavior, other challenges that that young person may need. And then our site coordinator will develop plans in addressing some of those challenges, working in partnership with the school. So tailored to each school and student.
What would be the most effective ways then for the neighborhood community leaders and the people who own businesses in that neighborhood directly around the school to support the school's mission?
That's a great question. So there's a lot of ways that externals can support the school. We have various volunteer opportunities that we can connect the school with as it relates to, for example, if you wanted to provide supplies to students, whether they be academic supplies or basic kit needs. And we're finding that a lot of those things are very helpful when other folks from corporations, businesses want to help support that individual school and those students. They can find ways to volunteer at the school, whether it be through report card conferences or other volunteer opportunities that the site coordinator will help put together with the school. We'll see a lot of different ways that some of the associates at many of these businesses are looking for volunteer opportunities, whether it's putting together kits for high schoolers, middle schoolers, elementary students that are age appropriate and that lend to the development of those young people. So those are just a few ways that businesses can connect with the schools in their particular neighborhoods or communities.
Many people argue that the school is, in fact, its own community. How do you foster collaboration between school staff and parents and grandparents and then community resources? Because sometimes the school has to reach beyond classroom education to support their students.
Absolutely. I think a lot of schools, they're so concentrated on the academic piece and the whole school and the whole child development within the school, but they may not have the capacity to connect with all of the other pieces that surround those students, whether they be external, parents, caregivers. So being able to effectively communicate and have a good opportunity to be connecting with those entities consistently with consistent messages of support and what does the family need. And that's one unique piece about our work is not only are we connected with the student, we are also connecting with the families as well as necessary based off maybe what that child is dealing with. If there's a certain barrier that the site coordinator can help address in partnership with leadership at the school, say a school counselor or a school psychologist, maybe the social worker. The great thing about what our site coordinators do, they aren't just an entity coming in and just, you know, as a particular type of vendor. The goal is for them to be a part of the culture of the school and continuing to collaborate. That's a big word, collaborate with the school leadership so that there can be more communication with those parents, caregivers, other entities, other nonprofits, other community resources that the school could take advantage of or participate in. And having that site coordinator can be that conduit if the principal doesn't have time and he or she's doing so much work, teachers in the classroom, there's other things that they have to concentrate on. But to have this other entity come in and be a partner and bringing those resources to bear is very, very beneficial for both parties.
We're living in a time where more and more students are experiencing food, transportation, and housing insecurity. And the 1-2 punch is it comes at a time where funding is being cut. And that's not just at the local level, but it's at the state and federal level as well. How do you combat that 1-2 punch?
That's a very, very good question because as an organization, as an affiliate of the Communities and Schools National Organization, we are also seeing those challenges when it comes to funding. We are understanding the challenges that school districts themselves are experiencing when it comes to funding, and then our other partner nonprofits that are dealing with those types of things. One of the things we do is, I'll go back to that collaboration again, and looking at additional resources that we can bring in and having those longstanding partnerships, understanding what the needs are of the school. We spend a lot of time building different types of collaborations and coalitions here locally and across our portfolio in the state, seeing where those synergies can happen. Some of those do have a cost associated with it. Others, we're able to forge those partnerships so that we can get the best bang for our work with those respective organizations that provide services, whether they be around connecting a family that is transient or what's going on with the student. They're missing school because transportation became a problem. Car broke down, parent lost a job, they missed the bus. All these things that are happening, figuring out what those are and where we can bring different types of resources to bear. There was one family I was learning about in one of our schools. They had been transient. They had moved from apartment to apartment, which was affecting their child's attendance, in turn affecting their behavior and their academics. Come to find out that mother had lost her job, got kicked out of their apartment, couch surfing here to there. So one of our site coordinators was really instrumental in bringing some resources and connecting with other nonprofits as it relates to low-income cost housing and able to get them connected, do the application, because that mother didn't know what the steps were. She didn't have anyone guided her. And to have someone walk alongside her to help connect to those resources that are dedicated to that particular type of work was very beneficial. So even with the funding being cut and we're seeing dollars, you know, reduce and dissipate, we still have to find opportunities to partner with our other resources and other nonprofits locally so that they can be able to help us guide resources for young people and their families.
Is that the primary reason why Columbus schools are experiencing perhaps the highest rate of absenteeism in the state, or are there other contributing factors?
I think there are a bunch of contributing factors for any school district, you know, Columbus being the largest, but for any school district that we're working with and we learn what's going on, that's why that assessment and understanding of what each individual school is dealing with is so important. And one of our main goals in working with schools that we take a lot of pride on and gather a lot of metrics and data is around attendance. And a lot of those, it's a myriad of reasons as to why it may look different in elementary versus middle or even high. So if talking with different site coordinators, you'll find a different types of reasons as to why students are chronically absent from school. It could be something from home. It could be something as it relates to a mental health or a basic need. It could be anything that maybe there's something financial going on. And I talked about students who may be transient or moving around, and that impacts their ability to go to school consistently. You have some young people that I've learned about that I've even talked to and said, well, school's not really my thing, and I have to get a job to support the family. I can only go to school for this amount of time, so why even go at all? I can make more money. I can contribute to the family if I go out and make some money because of these other circumstances. So there's a whole bunch of different reasons. I don't know if it's necessarily anything that the school is not doing. It's some things that these non-academic barriers that we talk about so much that the school tries to address. But then there are some things that, you know, the families are just dealing with, that having those additional supports and constant communication and connection to resources is very, very key for the schools and for the nonprofits working with these young people and families.
How long have you been in your role as CEO?
About a year and a half.
So what's your proudest moment so far?
Proudest moment so far? That's a great question. The proudest moment, well, we have a great team. So going out to the different schools and sort of shadowing the site coordinators and listening to the principals talk about how much they appreciate the partnership. And then the different instances where you'll see students connecting with the site coordinators in real time, and you can see the relationship piece. So those are some of my proudest moments since I've been here.
Where can we go to learn more about communities and schools?
www.ciskids.org.
All right. We want to thank CEO Adaro Robinson for joining us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Rent Cafe recently released its study of the 150 most livable metro areas in the United States. 8 Ohio cities made national rankings, with one in the top 10. That city is our very own Columbus. Alexandria Both, a senior researcher at Rent Cafe, was deeply involved in the project and joins us now on Columbus Perspective magazine. Welcome.
Hi, Jay. Nice to be with you.
We're grateful for you. How long did it take to complete the survey from start to finish?
Well, usually this is a few weeks' work. We gather the data and then we apply all the metrics and put together the ranking, of course. There are a few review stages to make sure everything is correct and some fact-checking stages, of course. And we put out this report every year.
How many metrics were involved?
So this year, we used 17 key metrics, including cost of living, healthcare access, and community appeal. And these metrics are grouped into three core categories. So we have socioeconomics, quality of life, and location and community.
What was the methodology behind the research? How did you get your data?
So we use different public data sources like the Census Bureau, and this year we analyzed 149 U.S. metro areas, the largest by population, and we analyzed them across these 17 key metrics. And I want to give you some examples just so everyone understands what we looked at specifically. So across the three categories that I mentioned, we have socioeconomics, which includes factors like cost of living, income growth rate, and unemployment rate. And then we have a second category, quality of life, which covers criteria like access to healthcare providers and healthy food and opportunities for exercise. And then the third category, location and community, looks at the share of higher educated residents, the social association rate, access to arts, entertainment, recreation venues, and the share of residents with long commutes, among other factors, of course. Now, together, these three categories form the main pillars we use to define livability. And based on each metro's performance across the individual metrics, we created both an overall ranking and separate rankings for each category.
Now, Columbus ranks 7th in the nation overall and 1st in Ohio overall. What was the contributing factor to this high ranking for the capital city?
So there were a few factors that contributed to Columbus's high ranking this year. So Columbus emerged as Ohio's most livable metro areas after jumping 28 spots to the 7th place nationwide, like you mentioned. And there are a few things I want to mention here. And the first is that it also ranks highest in the state for socioeconomics. It's 31st nationwide among the 149 metro areas we looked at, even though it has the third highest cost of living in the state, which is still 4.7% below the national average. But of course, there were other factors that we looked at which pushed Columbus high in the rankings. And I will tell you more about this in a second. I just want to find a few notes that I made regarding this ranking. In addition to the cost of living that I mentioned, many residents here have access to exercise opportunities. So it's 89%, which is an increase compared to 75% a year before. And we have more people working out than a year before, and a smaller share of people that are facing severe housing problems. So we've seen a decrease in this rate from 10.6% a year ago to 8.3% this year. And this is the third best rate nationwide.
So where can we go to view the entire survey?
For the full report, including detailed insights on all 149 metro areas, please visit rankcafe.com/blog under Market Insights. The report features a fun interactive table where listeners can see how their metro performed. You just have to type in the metro name or state abbreviation to explore all the data.
All right. We want to thank you for being a part of our show today and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
In New Albany, billionaire businessman and philanthropist Les Wexner faced questions from congressional investigators about his ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Wexner was deposed at his New Albany mansion. He has never been charged in connection to Epstein and denies knowing about Epstein's crimes. Lawmakers flew in to ask about his relationship with the convicted sex trafficker. Wexner's influence is known far and wide. He founded the city of New Albany back in the 80s, created fashion brands like The Limited, Victoria's Secret, and Bath & Body Works. His name is also associated with many buildings and places around Central Ohio, including Ohio State University and the OSU Wexner Medical Center. The U.S. House Oversight Committee, which is conducting the investigation, released the video of the complete deposition. It runs 5 hours. In a statement, Wexner describes his relationship with Epstein as strictly business. Here's a clip from the deposition in which Wexner is asked if he knew anything about Epstein's crimes.
With the benefit of hindsight, were there any things you witnessed or observed about Mr. Epstein that could have suggested he was trafficking and sexually abusing women?
Absolutely not. I've asked myself that question over and over, why I didn't see the there should have been a clue or something that I should have picked up on. There's nothing that I can recall, nothing, not even a clue of a clue. And I think the reason, in hindsight, and I think for the understanding to get to the bottom of what Jeffrey did, is to understand how great a con he was, because that's the explanation I have to myself. How could I have never thought he was a thief? How could I never thought he was a pervert? You know, all the terrible things. Never clue.
Just under 2 hours into the deposition, Wexner is asked if he ever visited Epstein's island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Here's his response.
Can you tell us about those visits?
Yes. Jeffrey invited us to see it, and we were on a boat. We went to the island with our kids. So Abigail, myself, and I can't remember how many kids we had, two, three, or four, but at least two, walked around for a while and left. Probably an hour visit.
Okay, an hour. So on that trip, do you recall seeing any prominent figures on the island?
No, and it was a pretty crummy island.
Now, you can watch the full nearly five-hour deposition on 10TV+. During a break in the deposition, Democratic members of the House Oversight Committee gave their impression of Wexner's relationship with Epstein.
There would be no Epstein Island. There'd be no Epstein plane. There'd be no money to traffic women and girls. Mr. Epstein would not be the wealthy man he was without the support of Les Wexner.
Again, Les Wexner denies any wrongdoing and any knowledge of Epstein's crimes. In a statement Wexner released Wednesday morning, he says he cut ties with Epstein nearly 20 years ago when he found out Epstein was stealing from him. In that statement, Wexner says, quote, I never witnessed nor had any knowledge of Epstein's criminal activity. I was never a participant nor co-conspirator in any of Epstein's illegal activities. To my enormous embarrassment and regret, I, like many others, was duped by a world-class con man. I cannot undo that part of my personal history, even as I regret ever having met him. In the statement, Wexner acknowledged again that he met Jeffrey Epstein in the 1980s and says he cut ties with Epstein in 2007 after learning about his, quote, abusive conduct and the theft from the Wexner family. Democratic lawmakers conducting the deposition say they believe Wexner is downplaying his relationship with Epstein. 10 Investigates reporter Rochelle Aleem has more on that.
How close were Jeffrey Epstein and Columbus businessman Les Wexner? That's a question members of the House Oversight Committee are hoping to answer. In a three-page statement Wednesday to that committee, Wexner called himself naive and said Epstein had conned him, and he outlined their relationship as one of business. Committee members said Wednesday they believe Wexner is minimizing the extent of his relationship with Epstein.
The more this deposition goes on, the less Les Wexner knows about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. It's interesting that Mr. Wexner has already begun to clarify in his mind that somehow he and Mr. Epstein weren't even friends. We should be very clear that the two were very close per reporting.
In the statement, Wexner said that he did not socialize in Epstein's circles and that he visited Epstein's island only once for a few hours shortly after its purchase with his wife Abigail and his young children. He said the side of Epstein he saw was, quote, far different from the predator he eventually was exposed to be.
10 Investigates reporter Rochelle Aleem has been covering all the developments around the Les Wexner deposition very closely. She was in New Albany all day Wednesday for the deposition. I talked with her earlier about the key points and highlights from that day. Rochelle, what was your big takeaway from deposition day?
So we actually had five lawmakers from the House Oversight Committee come out to update the media on the deposition. We thought they were going to come and talk to us once it was over, but they told us they were on a break in the middle of the deposition. And they came out to give us kind of a flavor of how things were going. One thing that really stood out to us, we weren't sure if Les was going to plead the fifth. He had the right to plead the fifth and have an attorney speak on his behalf, but they told us that he was answering all their questions. He put out a statement beforehand, and then he was verbally answering their questions during that deposition.
Now, in the statement that he put out to the committee and to the public before the deposition, he was very adamant that he had no knowledge of Jeffrey Epstein's illegal activities. What were his key points in that argument?
I mean, in that statement, it was 3 pages long, over 2,000 words. He called Epstein a con man multiple times, said he was conned, he was naive, he should have never trusted him. He said he was only on the island once with his family, that he had no knowledge of any criminal activity from Jeffrey Epstein, that he had never been on the plane, and just said, again, he had been duped and had no idea that this was the kind of person he really was.
Now, the Democrats on the investigating committee didn't buy that, did they?
Yeah, I mean, during that update to the media, they said that he had credibility issues, that they felt that he was downplaying his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. That being said, shortly after that update from those lawmakers, we got a statement from his attorney again saying that he had answered all their questions truthfully.
And again, he has not been charged in connection
Correct.
With anything related to Jeffrey Epstein's illegal activities. Now, the Democratic members on the committee came here to New Albany. They carried out this deposition. The Republican members of Congress on the committee did not come here. They sent staffers to the deposition. Have you heard why they didn't make the trip as well?
That's a big question we still have. Those lawmakers expressed frustration. They felt that their counterparts should have physically been there for that deposition. They said it was very important. We did reach out to the chairman of the Oversight Committee. He's James Comer, a Republican out of Kentucky. We did reach out to his office to get some clarity as to why he or his other Republican counterparts didn't physically come out to that deposition, and we're still waiting to hear back.
All right, so where does this go from here? What's next?
That's a big question, right? At the end of that update from lawmakers, they said that the deposition would continue on for the rest of the afternoon, but they said the questions wouldn't stop there. They said they still had questions for Les Wexner, and they had other people in Central Ohio they would potentially question. We don't know in what capacity, if there will be other depositions, so we're also waiting to get an update on that as well.
So you've talked also about the deposition process and who can be involved and what not. So you mentioned we didn't know if the other people would be a deposition or it could just be questioning?
Correct. So to carry out a full deposition, you'd have to be subpoenaed.
Okay.
Or they could potentially submit questions maybe through somebody's attorney, which is a lower level of, I guess, importance. So we're waiting to see how they're going to carry out that questioning with anybody moving forward.
All right. Rochelle, you've been on top of this, and thank you for your continued reporting.
All right.
Lawmakers at the State House are also weighing in on the latest developments. Republican State Senator Andrew Brenner of Delaware is calling for Les Wexner to step down as chairman of the board of the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Brenner tells me the whole issue has become too big of a distraction for the medical center and Ohio State. Here's what the senator had to say. Why are you calling for Les Wexner to step down as chair of the board of Wexner Medical Center?
Well, I met with a group of the Strauss survivors last week via Zoom, and had a major impact on me. I've also been following the stuff that's been going on in Washington, D.C., with the various disclosures that have come out through the Epstein files, as well as some of the affidavits that were released last week. I think that at this point in time, it has become a major distraction for Ohio State. I believe that since he stepped down about 5 years ago from L. Brands, I think he should probably do the same thing at this point from Ohio State. Ohio State needs to deal with their Strauss issue and be able to move forward with that. I also think that, you know, with this more recent information that came out about one of the professors potentially having received money from Epstein, he denies that anything had to do with anything, and I'm going to go on his word, but these ongoing distractions are not helping the university. And I think that, and given the fact that Les Wexner is giving testimony, I believe, today in Congress, I think that he needs to, you know, let the university move on and, I think, try to put this behind them.
Now, Senator Brenner was referring to team doctor Richard Strauss. An independent investigation by OSU found Strauss sexually abused at least 177 male students over two decades. While OSU has settled with many of the Strauss victims, there is still pending litigation. I also asked Senator Brenner if he supports removing Wexner's name from buildings at Ohio State, as others have been calling for. He said he's not at that point, and it still has to be decided. More on this issue in just a minute. But first, other lawmakers are talking about the implications of Wexner's connections to Epstein. Lawmakers I talked to on both sides of the aisle say it's important that the investigation plays out and is thorough. They also say it's important the victims of Epstein are the focus.
I think if obviously these were horrible things. It sort of, in a larger picture, shows what happens when there's groupthink and people are turning their back in a particular situation. But we'll see what comes out of the deposition ultimately.
People who are involved need to be investigated and held to account, because these are not victimless crimes. These are not just headlines. These are people's lives that were ruined in really vile ways. And so I hope that the investigations are thorough and that they lead to some accountability for people who committed these heinous acts.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.